All right, counsel, we call our third case for today, number 20-50179, Academy of Allergy and Asthma et al. Versus Quest Diagnostics. Mr. Lowell, you're up first, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, we are here to request that the court reverse the district court's 12B6 dismissal of plaintiff's original complaint for five independent legal errors. First, the district court erred in requiring appellants to plead around the affirmative defense of limitations. Second, the district court improperly contradicted statutory and controlling authority for accrual of antitrust claims. Third, the district court improperly contradicted the Texas statute concerning limitations of the state law claims. Four, the district court improperly construed facts against appellants at the motion to dismiss stage. And five, the district court improperly dismissed with prejudice and without any leave to amend. Now, to understand why it took this long for us to get to this court, I'd like to put it just in a bit of context. For a long time, Quest misrepresented that it had nothing to do with FADIA's attempts to attack appellants in the market. But whenever it was put under oath, it admitted it did after responding in a subpoena the opposite way in 2016. And now they claim, well, you were too late to sue us. They filed that in a motion to dismiss on limitations grounds. And it was pending for over a year on the San Antonio desk of this district court for when he returned during the winter months, as he does every year, to clear the docket. And they had tried to convince this district court that he had seen this case before. And when he issued his four-page order dismissing the case, it seemed now then clear he had conflated this case with a different case, a case in which Quest was never a party, its conduct was never adjudicated, its rights were never brought before court. And in committing the many legal errors this court did in its opinion,
when you say the conduct was never adjudicated in that earlier Fifth Circuit opinion, there are fairly categorical statements about FADIA not having done illegal acts.
I understand that, Your Honor. There were allegations in the other case that FADIA and Mothers of Asthmatics, which is a patient advocacy organization, worked together to attack certain contracts. In this case, there are many more acts and many more efforts on behalf of Quest and FADIA, which did not involve Mothers of Asthmatics, which include misappropriating a customer list, which included trying to corner the allergy testing market, to which Mothers of Asthmatics has no interest in, but certainly Quest and FADIA do. And Quest was never tried in that case. All references to Quest were, in fact, excluded from the case and the trial, which is in the record in this case. And in fact, we won against FADIA. FADIA lost summary judgment and settled thereafter. We were never able to prosecute FADIA in front of a jury or Quest. And my clients deserve to stay in court against both of those because those two entities conspired whether or not Mothers of Asthmatics did or not.
And as to your antitrust claims, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr.
Go ahead, Judge.
I asked too many questions, but as the antitrust claim, you're the best overt act that's post December of 2013 is the email from FADIA to Quest as to how to pressure and discourage doctors. Am I right or am I oversimplifying it?
Your Honor, that is one of many we do plead in 2014, which is FADIA and Quest discuss how to coerce doctors. But we also plead, and these facts are taken as true in the complaint, that they in fact visited with those doctors, talked them out of contract or ending their relationship and eliminating themselves from the market with United Allergy. There are many facts pled from paragraphs 94 to 105 of the complaint of Quest and FADIA not only talking about how they're going to do it, but in fact doing that in places all over the country, including not only in Texas with Texas Health Resources in 2014, but North Carolina and many other states. That's why we believe that this court, in ignoring those facts or construing them against us, committed reversible legal error. Now, to to affirm the district court's ruling on when any of the five grounds I'm going to cover would undo clear statutory and long-standing legal precedent, and what it would reward Quest for constantly lying and obstructing the legal process to avoid accountability. The first and clearest, simplest legal error is that the district court erred in requiring appellants to plead around an affirmative defense of limitations. I know this court knows well that it reviews motions to dismiss de novo, takes all facts as true and construes them liberally in favor of the non-movement, including appellants. And it also does not require plaintiffs to plead around the affirmative defenses. Rule 8 only requires fair notice. And this court has not been hesitant to reverse a dismissal on 12b6 grounds on things that are raised in affirmative defenses, such as EPCO carbon dioxide in 2006. Only when the complaint forecloses the claim on its face makes it clear there is no viable cause of action under the affirmative defense is it possible for a 12b6 to be issued. Now, the correct place for affirmative defenses is the summary judgment phase, and there are many reasons for that. First, Quest would have had to bring its defense via motion with evidence. Second, there would have had to have been discovery. My clients would have been entitled to do that discovery and present its own contrary evidence. And even then, Quest would have had to prove limitations as a matter of law with no genuine issue of material fact. The standard in the district court opinion at 12b6 is quite different. It requires appellants to plead the perfect complaint, to overcome subsequent defenses, and to prove their case without any discovery, any consideration of the actual evidence, and certainly without a trier of fact. The second issue, and I believe Your Honor had just reached this in its prior question, is the contradiction of clear statutory and controlling authority for the antitrust claims. Now, even had this been summary judgment, the district court would have erred as a matter of law the way it applied the statute. Antitrust claims accrue with each injurious overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy. That's uncontroverted from the statutes themselves and from the case law. And because this complaint was filed in December of 2017, we only needed to plead an ongoing conspiracy to restrain trade as of December 2013. But as I mentioned earlier, appellant's complaint pleads multiple overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy in 2014, in 2015, in 2016. And these are new injurious overt acts, visiting with new potential members of the boycott and causing them to end their relationships with my client. And for those acts, whether taken by FATIA or by Quest, they're both jointly and severally liable. The statutes are clear that it's anything forbidden by the antitrust laws, according to the Clayton Act, or the Texas Free Enterprise Act on its face says any cause of action is considered to accrue at any and all times during the period of the violation. This court, and from Imperial Point's Colonnades to U.S. versus Thermal in 2004, make it clear that any act, whether by any co-conspirator, extends the limitations period. And this court, the district court, was explicit that it ignored the acts of FATIA, which it considered would be enough, did not consider in purposes of limitations. The district court also made this aftershocks a filter, essentially, to try and filter out certain acts. But the case law on which it seems to be relying are cases where the actual antitrust violation is a one-shot event. Like if there were a merger by Quest and FATIA more than 4 years before suit that was completed and all that occurred after that were damaged, that wouldn't count. Or if there were, in the case of Al George that this court handled, a monopolization suit under a patent claim that occurred more than 4 years and all that happened were repeated pleadings in the case, that wouldn't be a continuing violation. But this court was clear in Posters Exchange and Imperial Point's Colonnade when it's a concerted refusal to deal, even on summary judgment, any specific word or refusal to deal reaccrues the cause of action. As I mentioned before, Quest met with FATIA management to hatch the plan to attack UAS in February 2014. That's paragraphs 94 and 95 of the complaint. They visited positions throughout 2014 and 2015 to coerce them not to do business in this market, paragraphs 97 and 103 through 104.
I guess, tell me if I'm wrong, but I thought the district court was saying broad allegations of visiting with doctors are too nonspecific. And then as to your specific ones, you're right. The district court brought an array of arguments like the aftershocks argument, but primarily the district court was saying, you knew early on, 2012, that something's happening. Your customers are leaving you. And therefore, if the specific overt acts that allegedly continue the conspiracy aren't specific, the district court was saying that you never pled that you did much due diligence at all. You asked them for discovery and then you get it in May 2016. I thought that's the direction the district court's dismissal went in when it's looking at your complaint.
I understand, Your Honor. I agree with that reading. What I think the district court's doing at that moment is conflating two different standards. For example, the first standard is merely pleading under Rule 8, notice of acts. You don't have to complete, you know, plead to such specificity he seems to be requiring of a continuing violation with overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. And when reviewing the complaint as a whole, including the prior limitations act, so it's pretty clear that's what they're doing. They're continuing their illegal conduct with more injurious overt acts. Now, what the other part Your Honor mentioned concerns fraudulent concealment. That admittedly is a 9B standard. But yeah, that turns on factual questions on whether or not they were effectively hid their role and affirmatively misrepresented represented themselves in the conspiracy. And while that was my fourth point, I'm happy to go to that now because I know it's pertinent. But essentially, on the issue of fraudulent concealment, this court in Allen Constructions was pretty clear that it takes even much less to reverse a summary judgment for a plaintiff who claims that they have had a fraudulent concealment. The complaint is clear. The appellant served a subpoena on Quest in 2015. The complaint is clear with its attachment that Quest responded in 2016 in attachment F or record site 945 to 956 that it would, quote, produce documents in response to each of those categories of documents which Quest now admits would have unearthed its wrongdoing. And in March
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Back to Judge Higginson's initial point. Again, the district court emphasizes the fact that before 2013, back in 2012, UAS is losing customers, and yet there's nothing pled in the complaint to show that there was any diligence whatsoever to find out why the customers were leaving, what was going on, and basically that it was easily ascertainable that Quest would have been involved with Vadia and the other alleged co-conspirators. How's the district court wrong?
Your Honor, we believe the district court is wrong by first injecting that into the dismissal phase because that requires a factual predicate at summary judgment on what is reasonable diligence. But quite frankly, we'll say this. The complaint was filed in 2014 against the known actors, Allergist, and was updated in 2015 against the known actor, Fadia, and then was quickly followed by a subpoena to Quest, who merely was suspected of having some knowledge of maybe what Fadia was doing, who then Quest affirmatively misrepresented that they had nothing to do with it when we know that now to be true because the documents Fadia produced in 2016. That's sufficient diligence, or at least a fact question of diligence on summary judgment.
I may have just missed this, but in the original action that involved the other parties, didn't involve Quest, were there any John Doe defendants alleged or any allegations about other conspirators? You may not have known the name, for example, but you might have known there were others involved. Were there any allegations like that against fictional parties? Does that matter?
I'm not sure that matters in the context of an antitrust violation, Your Honor, only because it's pretty common to find co-conspirators at different points in time and bring them in different actions. But I will say that we did plead that we were aware that there was conduct ongoing by the allergists with potential co-conspirators who at that time seemed to be Fadia. Expanding it to Quest, who had previously said they were not involved and, in fact, guaranteed in writing they wouldn't use a customer list only to find out that representation was false, seems reasonable to rely on. It's a Fortune 500 company. To believe that it would be lying in that respect seems wrong.
State law claim of misappropriation, that's specific to them giving over your doctor list?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that one is out of time, but your answer to that is that you did the best you could, at least to get past 12B6, in terms of you couldn't have known it? Is that's what you're saying?
Not only we couldn't have known it, but the statute is clear. It's not out of time until the defendant proves that the misappropriation was discovered or should have been discovered. It doesn't start to accrue until discovery. So we don't believe it was out of time until discovered in 2016, yet efforts were made. And if any event, fraudulent concealment would definitely save that claim as well. But the last issue is the fact that the district court denied or dismissed with prejudice and without leave to amend. Rule 15 is clear. It applies post-judgment on dismissals of free leave to amend absent a substantial reason not to. And his substantial reason not to is that his opinions are not to be quarreled with. We've supplied tons of evidence explaining additional overt acts during the conspiracy and answering these questions about reasonable diligence, and we believe the court should have entertained those rather than just refuse to consider those additional factual findings. I understand my time is inside.
At the time that the district court ruled against you and dismissed, and you know, with prejudice, are you saying at that point did you have or were you armed with arguably a putative amended complaint that was fleshed out and had more, had you not been poured out on prejudice? Or, you know, was your argument for reconsideration to the district court that it had erred for all the reasons you've already said?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. I believe our 59E motion spells out very detailed factual allegations that we believe address the district court's concerns that, quite frankly, were raised, many of them sua sponte, including questions of diligence that we did not anticipate we would have to plead around given their nature as an affirmative defense, but also additional action we believe that clearly accrues the cause of action, or at least demonstrates the original theory that the cause of action is forever dead is an inappropriate determination by the district court on a 12B6.
Okay, when the case was originally there, by recollection, the case was handled by Judge Yackel, is that right?
Actually, Your Honor, it was handled by Chief Judge Garcia, and it was...
Yeah, okay, yeah, Chief Judge Garcia, all right.
That's correct.
And he had the first trial or proceeding, the other case, he took that to fruition, right?
No, Your Honor, he issued multiple opinions, including on summary judgment, and then transferred the case for trial to Judge Lamberth, which is a common practice in that district to have cases tried. This case got assigned to Judge Lamberth merely because they were seen as related. Typically, this probably would have gone to a Judge Garcia.
Okay. Well, it's not dispositive, but I did gravitate to your sort of gratuitous point when you started about, and I happen to know that, you know, Judge Lamberth's on the D.C. circuit and you know, is a winter home in San Antonio and comes down and helps him. And your sort of gratuitous point when you started was that the judge had come down to clear the winter docket. And then you argued that, well, he conflated, you know, what the case was about and so forth. So that point wasn't lost on me. So I was trying to figure out, well, what thunder were you trying to make at a point of sort of like, well, he left and when he came back, I mean, he wasn't fully tuned in on this. He's got a stack of cases and so forth. Again, not dispositive, but I'm trying to be clear. What's the point you're trying to make? And then, you know, what's the drift on his conflating it, so to speak, is what you're arguing. And thus you're implicitly arguing that when he got it, he was unmindful of FATIA and he issues a 4-page ruling and pours you out with prejudice. I mean, that's the guts of what you've argued, isn't it?
That's right, Your Honor. And I'll just point it this way. I do have respect for Judge Lamberth, and I was not only surprised, I'm somewhat struggling with understanding that ruling. And that's my best explanation, given the legal error.
All right. I understand. I mean, I know you're an officer of the court and you know, you're representing your client. But like I said, I had to sort of grab a hold to that, you know, sort of piece of it to kind of see what, you know, what was going on there. OK, we've got your argument and you've saved some time for rebuttal. So, counsel, Ms. Hammer, let's hear from you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. District Court's judgment should be affirmed. That the district court recognized this case is not just untimely. It's an attempt to relitigate a prior case that appellants tried and lost, not one that the judge conflated, but one that the judge accurately understood because he sat as the trial judge for that case. A jury rejected the appellant's claims. Now they're pleading the same facts, the same conspiracy, the same alleged tortious interference, repeating mostly verbatim the same factual allegations, but now against Quest as the ringleader of the conspiracy. They knew about Quest, they pursued discovery from Quest in the prior case. There were specific allegations about Quest in the prior case. The district court properly rejected appellant's tactical decision to defer asserting claims against Quest until they were untimely. And the judgment should be affirmed for three main reasons. One, there's no timely overt act alleged within any relevant limitations period. Two,
counsel, let me stop you right there and ask you about what counsel said about this 2014 email. We're at the pleading stage, and the email certainly is, I guess, from Thadia to Quest, and it references meetings, and it references a current client or customer of UAS, and it says something like pending phasing down or whatever that email says. How is that not enough to allege an overt act in 2014 within the statutory period at the pleading stage?
Thank you, Your Honor. And the precise allegations are not, in our view, specific acts or words of refusal, the words of poster exchange, a new overt act that would cause injury to the plaintiffs. They're describing general sales collaboration and marketing efforts by Fadia and Quest, not competitors. Quest is a reference laboratory. Fadia is an instrument supplier. Normal commercial behavior. At most, the two things that they're referring to, the May 2014 exchange concerning Texas Health Resources, a customer, was that that entity was, quote, directing away from usage for UAS. Not that it was doing so at the behest of either Fadia or Quest, but at most, if it were doing so, if it were at the behest, it's referencing a prior agreement to market and give information to providers and payors that's alleged to have occurred in 2011.
How would we at this stage interpret those facts in your client's favor? That may be an explanation that comes to light, but when you, for example, Poster Exchange and Rx.com, I know that's unpublished, those are all at the summary judgment stage, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Kaiser Aluminum is at the motion to dismiss stage. Whenever there is a fact alleged on the face of the pleading that shows that there is no that the limitations there's right. No overt act within.
Yeah, I looked closely. I mean, that's the three cases you give on page 16: Jones, Thomas, and Kaiser. But it does seem to me that there the plaintiffs did concede the last act was before.
Your Honor, in both Rx.com and also in Poster Exchange, the court was very clear that a specific act or word of refusal needs to occur at summary judgment stage, but here one has to be alleged. There's no specific act or word of refusal alleged. What they're alleging is sales meetings with customers where customers are announcing a decision, and as described in their allegations, Fadia and Quest recognizing as an opportunity to collect sale. At most, Your Honor, what those facts allege is the prior agreement that they specifically allege was in 2011, and the effect of that agreement. The jurisprudence as we read it for the limitations argument or boycott case for Poster Exchange, Rx.com in particular, the boycott act before the limitations period is the overt act. A new specific act or word of refusal is required during the limitations period. The idea, true for all antitrust cases for the limitations issue, is there an act by the defendant that injures the plaintiff? Not is there an effect from a prior pre-limitations act that injures the plaintiff? And even construing those facts, which are we think sparse and simply show normal sales activity with no actual anti-competitive conduct, even you construe it in the appellant's favor, it simply shows the effect of prior alleged events. Same is true with the Parkland visit in paragraph 98, record at 52, the other 2014 act that they alleged. That's alleging a dissemination of the OIG report. In addition, Your Honor, as we've said, most of these acts, all these acts, are acts of FATIA, not of Quest. And this is a different case. This is not just a cold pleading without a record. All of these facts are in the record in the prior case. And to the court's earlier point, Quest was specifically referenced in the prior case.
I did notice that, but what's the legal consequence? Quest wasn't a party. They wouldn't have necessarily thought that they need to even explore in that direction.
So it goes to the diligence question that was discussed previously about whether they were diligent in pursuing their claims and discovering claims, but also it, because they're trying to attribute the conduct of FATIA as the overact that is attributable to Quest and preserve the claim against Quest. In this case, the FATIA acts alleged disseminating the OIG report was specifically addressed in the prior case. This court said, and I'm quoting, FATIA did circulate the OIG opinion, but this was not tortious or wrongful, and it did not falsely represent that the opinion referred specifically to UAS, but rather truthfully said that it referred to a similar business model, even if FATIA's conduct was expressly designed to put UAS out of business. It was not independently tortious or unlawful and cannot support a claim of tortious interference with prospective business relations. They're attributing the same record, the same facts, the same allegations of FATIA's conduct between December 2013 and December 2017 that was already adjudicated in the prior case and attributing it to Quest. We think that on the unique circumstances of this case, even construing the facts favorable to plaintiff, that's not a new act by any party within the limitations period that caused harm. Quite the contrary, it's not a wrongful act. It's not an anti-competitive act. And I want to emphasize that many of these allegations were specifically mentioned in the prior complaint and encourage the court to review that. The reference to outreach to Parkland was specifically alleged in the FATIA complaint at 152, record at 254. The reference to Superior Health Plan, again, a decision by them, by Superior, to require pre-authorization of skin tests in May 2014, that at best is a reaction to the alleged agreement in 2011, which was specifically alleged as the only agreement. Let me also underscore one thing that is not clear in the argument that was presented earlier. What they are alleging is a boycott. They're alleging that UAS was boycotted by Quest at the behest of FATIA. That specific is the agreement they're alleging. That's at 57, record at 35. That is the same allegation, almost verbatim, from 2011 that's alleged at paragraph 140 of the FATIA complaint, record at 241, 242. There is no act by Quest of refusing to deal with UAS. That's what they say, that Quest refused to deal with UAS at the behest of FATIA. There is no act alleged at any time after 2011 by FATIA or anyone else that Quest refused to deal with UAS. The allegations are focused on collaborative marketing by FATIA and Quest to target customers, which again is pro-competitive behavior. As the district court noted in its decision on the judgment notwithstanding the verdict in the prior case, disseminating truthful information is pro-competitive, not a harm to competition. The additional facts alleged, again, we don't have an amended pleading here. We don't have anything other than documents that were submitted in the 59E motion, but none of those documents would change it. They're all of the same character of the documents the allegations that are in the complaint. They're simply alleging joint marketing activity between FATIA and Quest to take advantage of sales opportunities. And I'll be specific. They are alleging a consultant was hired. There's nothing about Quest, nothing about boycotting UAS. That's the record at 1010, 1045. They're alleging both at 1191 and 1125 and 1187 in the record that there were generic sales efforts between FATIA and Quest, recognizing that UAS was succeeding in the market. Nothing about boycotting them very innocuous generic sale collaboration.
Why am I wrong? Am I wrong in thinking that these arguments aren't necessarily time bar arguments? They're the failed to state a claim in the, at all, but strictly speaking, just time bar. I think they cited, or I'm sure you're familiar with the USPPS case, which as to both fraudulent concealment and the discovery doctrine said, this is really better left to summary judgment. These are intensely fact-specific determinations. They've alleged things happened afterwards that go to each of their claims. And is your answer, well, no, if you look at them, they don't state a claim, or that those acts like your alleged email by your client of their doctor list somehow wouldn't be a misappropriation?
Yes, Your Honor. All those would not change anything. They're not actionable on their face. None of them suggest any wrongful conduct under any cause of action. So even if they were asserted in an amended pleading, they would not state a claim. So that's point one. Point two, again, this is an unusual case with an extraordinary opportunity to get information. For fraudulent concealment, it's a very conclusory allegation of fraudulent concealment. They've not alleged any active concealment by Quest. Quite the contrary, they have not identified any act that we took to conceal. They simply alleged that we responded to discovery. And they have not identified any fact, any document, any topic, if known today, would change the claim. There's nothing specific they've identified that was, in fact, fraudulently concealed. Quite the contrary, everything they're alleging is from the old record in the prior case that's been known to them for many years, including years before they filed their suit. So it's unclear what they claim was fraudulently concealed that would have disclosed to them a claim that they could have and should have asserted. So the trade secrets claim, as the court has correctly identified, is a single fact, a single alleged event in 2011, a single customer list given to Phadia and allegedly used by Phadia. As the district court correctly concluded, there's absolutely no reason that could not have put them on notice to inquire further. And they had all the tools through discovery to inquire further had they chosen to do so. It's now been 10 years ago, and this is not a near miss on the trade secrets claim. It's a miss by a long margin. And even if it were not untimely, there are not sufficient facts alleged that a list of customers was protected by UAS as confidential, or that they couldn't have quickly identified if they were, in fact, as they alleged, losing customers, couldn't have identified that there was a trade secret violation by use of that customer list. Your Honors, there have been many bites at the apple here. This is, again, an unusual case because there was an opportunity to plead to cure the defects that were identified long ago on many occasions. We still don't have a proposed amended complaint. They didn't submit one on the 59E motion. They didn't submit one in opposition to the motion to dismiss. They chose to stand on their pleading and not amend at the motion to dismiss stage. And I submit, based on the fact that all of their allegations are based on the prior case, all of this could have been alleged much earlier in the prior case if they wanted to. The district court correctly focused on the allegations in the pleading. They chose to stand on the pleading, and that's fine, but they're standing on this pleading. On all the issues we've discussed, the fraudulent concealment, which is very scantily alleged, and the only overt acts in December 2013 through December 2017 are either very general acts of collaborative marketing or acts such as disseminating the OIG report, which have already been rejected in the prior case. And I emphasize also that for the other claims, tortious interference, the civil conspiracy, the trade secrets claims, those have to be between December 2014 and 2017 or December 2015 and 2017 with a 2-year statute of limitation. There is nothing alleged at all in that period. All they point to is paragraphs 103 and 104 of their complaint, which is a very conclusory and generic allegation of continuing violations. No customer, no specific meeting, no person, no communication. And the court was correct to reject those as insufficiently specific. I would emphasize that the statute of limitations is not a mere technicality. It means something. It's important. And this is a classic example of a plaintiff tactically choosing to sit on its rights and not bring a timely claim that it has known about for a very, very long time now. It had opportunities to cure its defects and chose not to do so for tactical reasons, all of which are within its rights. However, unfortunately for them, their claims are in fact untimely. They were not alleged sufficient facts to bring them within any statute of limitations. And this long litigation saga should come to an end. Thank you.
All right, any other questions from the panel? Nope, we're good. All right, thank you, sir, Mr. Hammer. All right, Mr. Lowe, we're back to you for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. I'd like to, again, address the fact that this is somehow the same case and that this is tactical. Quest was never tried in the last case. All references to Quest were excluded by the trial court. That's at record site 751 to 764. We won against Fadia. It's through that discovery we discovered Quest. So it's no wonder the complaints are similar because they're co-conspirators. And my clients are entitled to their claims in day in court against Quest, even if a nonprofit and an individual were not involved. That does not preclude Quest and Fadia from conspiring. I would like to address this idea that somehow there's a difference between having a prior agreement to conspire and carry out an antitrust violation and then having effects later within the limitations period is not furtherance of the conspiracy. All overt acts are in furtherance of a prior agreement. If you buy their theory on how you define what is an overt act that reaccrues the limitations claim, then you have no reaccrual. You have no continuing violations doctrine. Poster's exchange was clear on this. That proves too much. Of course, it's in furtherance of the conspiracy. Now, they want you to read it and cut it up in just the one act and say, well, that's not very specific. But when you read the whole of it, they had already conspired and reached their agreement in 2012. Of course, in 2014, when they're going after different customers and trying to exclude those from the market or coming up with a project that would corner the allergy skin testing market, of course that reaccrues or shows a continuing violation. The distinctions they would have you draw would eliminate the continuing violations doctrine, and more importantly, would just contradict the statute. It says any act in furtherance, any injurious act, and it's in furtherance of an agreement prior or during. It doesn't matter. It's the fact that they were in agreement. Now, they said that this is...
What does that leave for the after effects doctrine? What's left? You think that's just a very narrow exception?
I think this court did a very good job in Imperial Points Colonnades in 1977 and again in Thermal of explaining that doctrine. There are certain instances where a continuing violation doesn't save you. One is they put you out of business more than 4 years ago. Doesn't matter how much they beat your dead corpse, you don't have a claim because you can't be injured anymore. Or they took an act that harmed you more than 4 years ago, and the injury just merely accumulates over time as some injuries do. That doesn't save you. That's Imperial Points Colonnade. But when they continue to take further acts and furtherance of a refusal to deal by collecting other members of the boycott, by continuing to harm the plaintiff, that plaintiff has a right of an antitrust violation for good reason. Congress legislated that because it's important. It's not just important to these plaintiffs or these appellants, it's important to the market, to consumers. If Quest had it right, you know what? They think they can control a monopoly for the rest of time because
I'm just curious because you know the record better than I do, but in the additional evidence that you did submit, a month after the dismissal, does that actually finally have some doctors saying, yeah, they came to us? Is it really pretty explicit as to doctors being disassociating because of their behavior? Is that what we find?
What we find in that are things like Quest and Fadia both admitting that they ghost wrote letters to convince the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority to stop. They do have discussions of convincing doctors to stop. During 2014, and it's a mountain of evidence. I know a lot of it's under seal. The point of that was not so much to say that we're not prepared to prove our case. We are. We deserve more discovery, too. And that would involve us putting doctors up at summary judgment or at trial. We don't need to do that in a complaint. It's too early from our perspective. They're trying to put us to the trial standard, at the not even the summary judgment standard, but the trial standard at the dismissal phase, and that's not appropriate. But yes, doctors will testify, Quest and Fadia caused them to stop during the limitations period. But quite frankly, I didn't have the clairvoyance or the smarts, I guess, to know that I needed to plead that in an amended complaint or in a complaint even whenever I'm not required to plead under Rule 8 around affirmative defenses. And so this is all new to me, unfortunately. The whole point under the fraudulent concealment thing is they say they never show you what the misrepresentation was. That's not true. They told us in response to a subpoena in writing in 2016 that they would produce documents regarding their contacts with physicians and the use of the customer list, and they didn't. They produced nothing. They sent a letter saying, here are your documents. Had none of these emails that we got from Fadia later that proved it, that they were in fact involved. Now look, the whole point of this is that the rules are clear. Rule 8, Rule 15, Rule 56, they work in a fashion. We don't need to prove our case in a complaint. That's for later. Our point is to put the defendant on notice and to hold us to that standard, because if you break the rules for this case, it's going to change the requirements of all litigants going forward, and we think that would be inappropriate.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lowe. Any additional questions from the panel?
Nope.
Either. All right. Thank you, Mr. Lowe. Mr. Hammer, we appreciate your responsiveness to the court's questions, your briefing and argument. The case will be submitted, and this concludes the third case for argument that the panel has. The two of you may be excused with the thanks of the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.